Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Ask five people what alternative form of energy might best someday supplant fossil fuels, and you're likely to get five different answers. Some out there are bullish on solar power, others hydroelectric or geothermal or biofuel, hydrogen, ethanol. Heck, there are ways to derive fuel from algae. But actually replacing coal, oil, natural gas, nuclear, well, that's a pretty tall order. Author Philip Orberg believes America's path towards energy independence is lined with windmills. And today on the program, we're going to discuss the future potential and possible challenges associated with expanding wind energy in America with Philip Orberg. He writes about it in his book, Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. Orberg is the former president of the Conservation Law Foundation, an environmental advocacy organization based in New England. Philip Orberg, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Glad to have you with us. And we welcome you to the conversation as well at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions on WILL's Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Phil, you write in your book that wind is an expanding force in the global marketplace. How much is it expanding?
Well, if you look at wind today, it is really expanding quite dramatically. Here in America, we now get about 4% of our total power from wind, which may not sound staggering, but that's enough to provide about 13 million households with all of their electricity needs. And the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, a government entity based in Golden, Colorado, has projected that by the middle of this century, we could be getting half of our total power needs from wind and solar alone. So we're looking at a technology that we might think of sort of anecdotally as having opened up the West with water pumping windmills in the late 19th and early 20th century, but it's really a thriving industry today that is expanding quite dramatically. Some states, for example, South Dakota already gets 22% of its power from wind, Iowa about 20%, and even Texas, which is the largest power-consuming state in the nation, gets about 7% of its electricity from wind. So we're already on our way, and a lot is happening abroad as well.
There could be an obvious answer to this question, but why is it that there are some states where a significant percentage of their energy is derived from wind and other states where it's a very small percentage?
If you look at a wind map of the United States, you'll see a large swath of windy areas that extends down from the Dakotas on through Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, and Oklahoma into Texas. Those are really the peak wind states. But we have good wind resources across much of the nation. The part of the nation where wind is weakest is actually the southeast. However, if you look offshore, there are very substantial wind resources that could be tapped there as well. Going back to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, it has done a study of our total potential wind resources, only looking at what they call windy areas, that is, areas where the winds can be tapped and where there aren't wilderness areas or settled areas. And the projection is that we could be getting about 10 times our total national power supply from wind on land. And if you add in offshore resources, we're talking about 14 times our current total power supply.
Well, and there are always organizations out there that will come up with a statistic like that, and there is that sort of big picture potential. But in practical terms, how do we get from point A to point B? If right now we're talking about 4% of the country is powered by wind, or the country's energy needs is powered by wind, how do you get incrementally to 10%, 15%, 20%? What are some of the keys to making that happen?
Yeah. Well, first, at the state level, there are standards that have been set called renewable portfolio standards. They set thresholds for renewable energy to be provided by, either owned by or purchased by, and then marketed by utilities. And Illinois, for example, has a renewable portfolio standard that calls for 25% of the state's total power supply coming from renewable energy by 2025. And that language is says that to the extent feasible, 75% of that should come from wind. Those kinds of standards, which have been set in 30 states, actually 29 states in the District of Columbia, are important drivers at the state level. In Illinois, there is a sales tax exemption on wind projects. There are also property tax reductions. Another advantage that Illinois, for example, has is that there is easy access to major transmission lines and close proximity to major electricity load centers like Chicago, St. Louis, et cetera. Those are all factors. At the federal level, there is a production tax credit that has been in effect intermittently since 1992, and it has been instrumental in leveling a very uneven playing field between wind and our more conventional power resources, coal, oil, gas, nuclear. That tax credit has been the subject of a hot debate between candidate Mitt Romney and President Obama. President Obama very strongly feels that this tax credit should be extended beyond its current expiration date of December 31st of this year. Romney feels that the free market should govern our energy policies. However, he's not willing to reduce our subsidies to the oil, gas, coal, and nuclear industries. So we already have a very uneven playing field, and this tax credit is a very important means of leveling that playing field until we have the political will, very frankly, to price carbon at an appropriate level so that we internalize the environmental damage that is done by our burning huge quantities of coal and gas as well. Gas we think of as a cleaner fuel, but it still is a very major contributor to our greenhouse gas emissions.
We can get back to the politics associated with this maybe later in the hour, but I wanted to first establish, in particular in your case, why wind versus solar or hydroelectric or geothermal or biofuel? There are so many different options out there in terms of alternative forms of energy that maybe someday in some way could supplant fossil fuels. What do you see as the potential in wind as opposed to all of those others?
Well, first, I wouldn't say as opposed to. I really think that we need to develop a variety of new energy resources. And so to paraphrase the president, an all-of-the-above policy, I think, is an appropriate one vis-a-vis renewable energy technologies. It happens that wind is a superabundant resource that can be tapped quite economically. The current technology that is used by wind farms has been refined over the decades quite dramatically since the 1980s, when a fairly rough and tumble assemblage of wind turbines were put up, frankly, too quickly in places like California, and they caused a number of technical problems as well as some issues in terms of wildlife impacts. Today's wind turbines are very efficient technologies that are great at capturing the winds. An advantage that wind has over solar, and again, I think solar is a very important resource to develop, but one advantage that wind has is that you can place wind turbines on farmland, such as is happening in several places in Illinois that I've visited, and the farmers can still farm right around those wind turbines or graze their cattle right around those wind turbines. A wind turbine takes about a quarter to a half of an acre out of circulation. So if you have a farm of several hundred or even several thousand acres, you're talking about a very, very minor encroachment on your ability to enjoy your land, and then you end up getting a substantial annuity from the wind farm developer for leasing your land to the developer.
Among the concerns that people have about wind turbines, some worry about the noise they can create if you live close to them. Is that an issue?
Siting wind turbines intelligently is a very important piece of moving wind power forward on a scale that can really make a difference in the coming years. The vast majority of wind farm neighbors are happy to have the wind farms in their midst. There certainly are some people who are not happy because turbines have been sited too close to their homes and they are bothered by some of the aerodynamic noise that these turbines make. These are large machines. The average the current wind blades are half the length of a football field, some of them are shorter. And so you're talking about a very large rotor sweeping through the air, and that is going to create some aerodynamic noise, and you don't want your house within a couple hundred feet of that turbine. Smart siting is a very important piece of the puzzle.
You also alluded to the fact that there are some environmental concerns, specifically depending on where these turbines are placed. Birds could fly right into them.
One of the huge changes since the 1980s has been with respect to birds. Places like the Altamont Wind Farm in California built chock-a-block wind farms where you had these turbines very, very close to one another, close to the ground, and that generation of turbines, they were smaller, but the blades would spin much more quickly. And they also sited these wind farms in areas that were the homes of large raptor populations, eagles and other such birds. And there were disturbing numbers of birds killed by those wind farms. The modern-day wind farm places wind turbines much more generously across the landscape. These turbines also stand much taller so that their blades sweep no closer than 100 feet or so from the ground. And they also turn much more slowly so that birds can see them. So the amount of bird kill coming from our modern wind turbines has been reduced dramatically, which is not to say it isn't a real concern. It is a concern. And in major migratory flyways, for example, wind farms have to be operated with great vigilance. There's an example of a wind farm in Bulgaria that has an on-site ornithologist, and when a flock of 30,000 white storks was detected flying toward the wind farm a year or two ago, the ornithologist ordered the wind farm shut down, I think it was 37 times over a two-day period, and not a single stork was harmed. So there is effective use of radar as well as the development of better turbine technology that can be used to minimize the adverse impacts on birds.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking about the future of wind energy with Philip Warburg, former president of the Conservation Law Foundation and the author of the book Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. To join our conversation with any questions or comments you may have about wind energy, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Or again, you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. You mentioned this concept of there are some areas of the country where they're very effective at capturing winds. How far along are we in terms of technology that allows us to, once that energy is captured, to maintain it, hold it, and then release it when it's needed? Is that something that we've reached a threshold towards yet?
One of the very important things that we need to develop in the coming decades is a smart 21st century power grid. And what that will mean is both that we need a better integrated grid so that electricity generated from wind farms in places like Wyoming, South Dakota, etc., can be effectively delivered to major population centers, and that could often be hundreds or even 1,000 or more miles away. The other thing we need to do is develop technologies that allow us to modulate our demand for electricity, and there are lots of ways to do that in terms of smart control of household appliances, air conditioners, refrigerators, etc. Another great tool that we could use, and this is where we get a double benefit from wind, is to develop an extensive network of electric vehicles. Those electric vehicles could be plugged in during the 22 to 23 hours a day that most people are not using their vehicles, and utilities could be both charging those vehicles and decharging those vehicles depending upon the ebbs and flows in wind in the area, wind-generated power, so that you can create a reliable, constant supply of electricity that perfectly matches demand for electricity. There are also ways to store wind through battery storage, through what's called pumped storage into reservoirs. This is happening in many parts of the country already, and not just because of wind, but because of other electricity generating technologies, where when electricity is cheap, power is used to pump water into storage reservoirs, and then when that power is needed, it's released from the reservoirs and generates additional power. That's a great way to, again, help even out the bumps in the availability of winds. But I want to stress that if we were to develop a grid that wasn't really based on state provincialism, which is the way our grid has been developed, but rather think of it as a regional and even national grid, then when the winds are blowing strong in Iowa, but not so strong in Illinois or Texas, the supply of electricity can be balanced between those different wind farms stretched across a great geographical area. You can also integrate solar energy into that grid system, because obviously the sun does not shine 24 hours a day, so you need to balance solar energy, especially during the nighttime hours, with other sources of power. So wind and solar have a certain kind of complementarity in that regard.
You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we are talking today with Phil Warburg, author of the book Harvest the Wind. We're discussing the future potential and challenges associated with the expansion of wind energy in America. We welcome your questions and comments about wind energy at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments via WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we'll begin this morning with Paul in Champaign County. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. You sort of just treated what I was talking about. It's unusual. But the idea that even in a region like Illinois, the idea of having it decentralized, this was brought home by a guy from the Union of Concerned Scientists to me, that even in an area not premising, you know, this long-distance transport of electricity, that the fact that the wind farms would be widespread and located in different areas, that this sort of undercuts one of the almost constant arguments about how, well, what do you do when the wind's not blowing? Well, the wind's blowing somewhere else, and it's not even that very far away often. So, but since you've treated that idea of the smart grid and that, perhaps I'll just pitch the Union of Concerned Scientists as a guest possibility, and also mention that they have a study about nuclear power that shows that the subsidies were basically netted out. We gained very little. It's a little complicated to explain, and it is a digression. But there's one other thing that I've had as a fancy, and perhaps this will sound like it's from Neptune, but I see these windmills being carried on the roads and stuff, and it just seems to me that I'm looking towards dirigible transport in the future as a means of air transport, but even in the near term, there's a lot of cranes that operate with that kind of thing, and that if we were delivering larger windmills to distant regions that maybe aren't road-served so well, that we would have a higher efficiency windmill, and we wouldn't be clogging the roads so much.
All right. That's
the least of it. I thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. It's an interesting question. Phil, how much of a challenge is it to get windmills to the locations where they can best serve us in terms of building up energy while still being connected to the grid?
Well, there's no question that, again, wind turbines are large and their components are large. So I spent a good deal of time with transportation people, actually followed a truck from Lake Michigan on down into Indiana, where in White County they were building a very large wind farm. And you definitely need the right kinds of roads for those developments. I've never heard the suggestion before about dirigibles, but it's an interesting one for transporting turbines to more remote areas that are not well served by roads. I do want to take up Paul's comment about nuclear subsidies, because mm-hmm. I think it's an important one. Nuclear power would never have taken off if it were not for a federal liability cap that was first put in place by the Price-Anderson Act back in the 1950s. What that act does is it indemnifies reactor owners and operators against the costs, the damages of a catastrophic accident. Today, that cap is at well below $500 million. And if you look at the Fukushima disaster, the damage, economic damage, is into the well into the tens of billions of dollars, not to mention the human suffering. And I think when we think about wind, there are certainly challenges regarding wind in terms of noise, in terms of impacts on birds. It's not a perfect technology, but I think we can't view it in a vacuum. We have to look at it in terms of, well, what technologies could we displace? Nuclear is certainly one of them. Nuclear has untold problems in terms of the unsolved problems of waste storage, in terms of the possibility of a catastrophic accident. And we know from Fukushima and Chernobyl and Three Mile Island that these accidents really can occur. And then the untold environmental havoc caused by coal combustion and coal mining. And we're deep into a debate right now about what fracking is doing to our water supplies and air supplies in our race to extract as much gas as we can from our subsurface resources.
Setting aside the environmental question for a moment, among the arguments that you make in your book for the expansion of wind energy are economic arguments, and you talk about the industries that could be impacted by greater expansion, the number of jobs derived from expansion of wind energy. Is there potentially a downside in that there's probably somewhere, one would hope, a ceiling in the amount of energy Americans collectively use? And if you increase the amount derived from wind, that's going to reduce the percentage in another industry. And it could be the fossil fuels. It could be nuclear. So setting aside those environmental concerns, those are big industries that do involve a lot of jobs in this country. Is there a concern that the number of jobs ultimately gained by expanding wind might not counter the number of jobs potentially lost in coal or oil or natural gas or nuclear?
Well, first we're talking about different kinds of jobs. In the wind industry, we're talking about clean energy jobs, and we're talking about jobs that are often in rural areas where it's very hard to come up with a new employment resource. I spent a good deal of time in rural Kansas, for example, and the jobs that wind technology has brought to places like Cloud County, Kansas, for example, where the Meridian Way wind farm was built in 2008, are the first real infusion of jobs that that county has seen in a very, very long time. So they make a difference in areas where jobs are very clearly needed. And often the trade-off is not so much between building a new coal plant, which is not likely to happen these days because of the regulations that fortunately have been placed upon CO2 emissions from coal plants, but it's continuing to operate existing coal plants, for example, existing nuclear plants. Our nuclear fleet is now 30, 40 years old, and there's a scramble to relicense those facilities because it's so expensive to talk about building new nuclear plants. So it's more a question, I think, of can we begin to replace our aging fleet of conventional and nuclear plants with a cleaner technology as opposed to simply going a more of the same route, which is what Mitt Romney seems to be proposing with his advocacy for coal, gas, and nuclear.
Well, there are those who would argue, though, that the key is to expand nuclear now as a short-term bridge to maybe 30, 40, 50 years from now, when the technology does exist to maintain capacity derived from wind power, and that wind and other alternative forms of energy really can meet the threshold, the demand that those fossil fuel technologies, nuclear technology currently provide.
The Department of Energy, interestingly, under George Bush in 2008, came out with a study called Wind Powering America, 20% by 2030. And that study talked very soberly about wind power providing a fifth of our total power supply within the next two decades. And the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, I told you before, talked about wind and solar meeting half of our power needs by the middle of this century. So I don't think we're in need of a desperate push to build nuclear plants as a kind of bridge to a renewable energy future. That renewable energy future is here. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory, in that study, said the technology that could be used to meet that 50% threshold is commercially available today. So this isn't an exotic fantasy about the future. This is a realistic, practical look at what we have at hand and what we could expand to create a fundamentally different energy future for ourselves and for our children and for our grandchildren.
Let's take another call. We have Doug on the line from Thomasboro. Doug, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. You know, if there were no tax subsidies or anything, tax credits, given the land rental costs, the construction costs, transportation and maintenance costs, where is the break-even point for a wind generator, say, installed on private property or, you know, for something like even a small utility? How many years would it take where the amount of costs that you went in there putting into it are going to equal what your cost is to buy it from another source?
Right now, if you were to look at the capital cost of installing a wind farm, it's about $2,000 per kilowatt, and that compares with, for example, a new gas plant, probably in the $1,000 per kilowatt range. A difference, however, is that once you build that gas plant, you have to fuel it, and you have to fuel it for decades to come. And the price of gas today is not the price of gas that we're going to see 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, partially because with this gas boom, we're not just going to be consuming that gas domestically. We're going to be looking for foreign markets for that gas, and we're going to be consuming more of that gas here at home, possibly for our motor vehicle fleet and possibly for electricity. So that price is going to go up. So the more relevant cost factor to look at is what's called the levelized cost of energy, and that is looking at the life cycle cost of a power plant, taking everything into account, the construction costs, the operation costs, the cost of decommissioning, the cost of the fuel. And if you do that, wind looks very competitive with gas. Wind is right now in the 5 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour range. Gas is right now at about 4.5 cents per kilowatt hour, and that price will go up over time. And coal is much more expensive and will be much more expensive because of the environmental controls that are appropriately being placed on coal plants. New nuclear plants would be much more expensive than wind. What wind does right now is almost compete in the marketplace, and that's where the 2.2 cent per kilowatt hour production tax credit is very important, because it actually makes wind competitive with new natural gas. Without that, gas does come out ahead, at least in the short term.
But I think, Doug, forgive me if I'm wrong, were you asking about the idea of just putting in a wind turbine or windmill on your own property to derive your own energy?
Absolutely. I mean, because at last home show, they had the windmill people, everything, and they were pushing it locally, and we're seeing some locals. So I'm not talking about a major utility. How much would it cost a break-even point for us to install a wind tower? Because we're out here in East Central Illinois, we're a rural area. And so running lines and power lines is there, and plus just the backup. So where is a break-even point? How many years would it take us to install one? Because they were estimating $50,000 for the total installation, you know, and everything else to get it set up for what the, you know, a rural need is out here for a farm. And so it's just like, we have to do this. Yes, we have to conserve. Yes, we have to use all the energies. Yes, we have to use solar. But how, at that expense, how can we justify, or where's the break-even point?
What you need to do when you're looking at a household wind turbine is compare it to the retail price of electricity and not the wholesale price of electricity. And I don't know what the exact retail price would be in your area. But there's no question that an individual household-scale wind turbine is a more costly undertaking than a commercial-scale wind farm per kilowatt hour of electricity generated. So there are a number of factors that you'd have to take into account in terms of the local retail cost, in terms of the cost of the equipment that you'd be purchasing. And I don't have those exact numbers, but there certainly are a good number of people who have decided to go that route and view it as an economically beneficial route over the long haul. That said, I think that the real impact of wind power is going to be at the larger commercial scale, and that's what we're seeing happen today. Solar is a different story to some degree, because solar is very easily adapted to household scale use. It's also quite expensive, We're seeing it used much more widely on the residential level.
Now, again, I'm going to keep Doug on the line for a second, because Doug, I don't know if you're in a situation where you have maybe farmland that you could potentially lease to a company that might be interested in installing windmills or wind turbines, and maybe that's a way, in theory, you might get back the cost, the expense of giving up that land. I don't know if that's a possibility.
Yeah, that's one of the things that everybody's balancing around here, because how much loss in cropland do we have,
right,
versus production over the long period for the rental on the windmill or just putting the windmill up to do your own cost? Because, say, for example, out here in the rural area, average electric bill, you know, per month, even with the drying bins and everything, which is a major cost for us, might be $150 to $175 a month. Okay, that's with the drying bins.
Right.
And so when you're looking at $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 installation before you come up with your maintenance costs, that's the big question, you know, that's in the mind here. Because when we ask the guys, okay, where's the break-even point? We've got to do something that sounds really good. How much does it cost to put it in to maintain it versus how much we're paying, and where do we start actually breaking even? And that's the question I haven't had answered yet.
All right. And I'll give Phil a chance to answer that again. And also, Phil, you may want to point out, I know in your book, for your book, you went to some farmers in Kansas who had leased their land and felt that they were better off leasing it, having wind turbines installed, getting, you know, annual influx of cash from whatever company was installing them, that exceeded whatever crops they might be able to grow on that particular patch of land.
Absolutely. Let me give you the example of the Meridian Way Wind Farm in Cloud County, Kansas. It's a wind farm that has 67 turbines. It generates enough electricity for 55,000 Kansas and Missouri households. And again, going back to the acreage required, if you take a quarter of an acre to a half of an acre for those 67 turbines spread over many miles, you're talking about a truly negligible amount of land set aside for those wind turbines. There are some access roads and transformer station needs as well, but the amount of land that is required is really quite minimal, and the payments that these landowners get are very substantial. One family that I visited has 9 turbines on their property plus a transformer station, and the payments they get each year come very close to 6 figures. Typically, for a 3-megawatt wind turbine, landowners are paid in the range of $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 per year per turbine. So, again, if you're taking a quarter of an acre out of service and you're getting that kind of a return, there isn't a crop on this planet that comes remotely close to the rate of return that would be providing to these landowners.
And just to tie a bow on Doug's question about purchasing one wind turbine and installing it, let's say it cost $48,000 and it's costing him $160 a month to pay for his electricity, and that one wind turbine provided all the electricity he needed on his land, and if that average cost per month for electricity now, if that were the case going into the future, it would take, 30 years for him to save, to reach the point where he's essentially paid off the cost of installing in the first place, right?
Yeah, as I said, I think that commercial-scale wind turbines are a better bet right now, and individual farmers and homeowners need to really look hard at what the trade-offs would be. That's certainly a long-term investment that some people may not be willing to make. Some people are making that kind of an investment.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're talking with Philip Warburg, author of the book Harvest the Wind. We're discussing the future potential and challenges associated with the expansion of wind energy in America. We welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email will-talk@illinois.edu. We are due for a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen Colbert returns to our show. He has a new book called America Again, Rebecoming the Greatness We Never Weren't. We'll talk about the book, his show, and his super PAC. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at cusaveenergy.com or 217-649-1173.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking about wind energy on today's program with Phil Warburg, former president of the Conservation Law Foundation and the author of Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. To join our conversation, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go next to Ron in Decatur. Good morning, Ron.
Yes, good morning. As I drive around the countryside and pass operating wind farms, frequently I'll see a number of mills offline, shut down, and it's kind of been my impression that coal-fired power plants are given the right, when, let's say, the power demand goes down, they're given the right to continue their operation, running their coal-fired turbines, and the windmills have to shut down. I'd like to know if that's correct, and if it is, what can we do to reverse that situation?
That's a very interesting question, and it's one that's being worked out in various parts of the country. First, one of the reasons you might be see some of the turbines down is that they may be being repaired. They have to be serviced every so often, and when the service people are up in the turbines, they turn the turbines off. But there is a real issue. For example, the Bonneville Power Administration has given priority to hydro over wind in their region, and that's created great consternation among wind farm operators out there because they are seeing a lot of their power curtailed so that hydro can be used unabated, especially during periods where they have surplus water supplies. There needs to be a good arrangement so that wind, when it's available, can be absorbed by the grid. And that again goes back to the need to develop a smart grid that is capable of balancing wind, solar, coal, gas, hydro resources in a manner that makes the best use of the lowest cost resource. And wind, once the farm is built, is the lowest cost resource, because once the wind farm is built, there's zero fuel cost and minimal operating cost. One of the wind manufacturers has estimated, for example, that all of the energy that it takes to build a wind turbine, operate it over its lifetime, and decommission it is made back during the first 7 months of that wind turbine's operation. So from 7 months on, you're basically getting, you could say, free energy. It's certainly free from an environmental standpoint. We need to take full advantage of that resource once these wind farms are built.
Let's go next to Guy in Mahomet. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm standing out here in my yard looking at my neighbor's wind turbine and very pleased that he's creative enough to do that. But my question is, how do we know who owns the wind farms? And wouldn't a better idea, rather than putting one up in your backyard where there's not necessarily the best wind, to take like 20 people at $50,000 each and put up your own turbine or buy into a wind farm and just look at that turbine and know that you've got your share of it and put the energy on the grid and kind of like an investment. Very much an investment.
There are a number of community collaboratives that are doing just that around the country. And I think it makes a whole lot of sense because, again, there are economies of scale in building these wind farms, and you can take advantage of that if you're putting up 50 turbines as opposed to a single turbine, and if you're putting up larger turbines as opposed to smaller turbines, and if you're feeding that power into the grid so that you're getting a return even when you might not be needing that power. So that's a terrific idea. One collaborative I actually visited in Wyoming was taking a very interesting approach, which was they assembled, this is on a larger scale, about 100,000 acres of land that they were looking for a wind farm developer to take on so that these ranchers together could be beneficiaries of a wind farm built on a very large commercial scale. But they weren't waiting for the wind developer to come to them. They were assembling the land package and then going out and soliciting bids from wind developers.
Let's next go to Paul in Urbana. Good morning.
Good morning. Much of what the guest says, I really like to hear. I'm really in agreement with him. I think wind power definitely has a place, but my problem comes when the guest becomes quantitative. Early in the guest comment, he said that wind produces 4%. So I'm looking at EIA annual report for 2011, and wind production was 1.2 quads. Total production of energy in the U.S. was 80 quads, so that's, you know, basically 2%, or the total consumption was 97 quads, so that's 1.5%. So the 4% that the guest gave, I just don't see that number. The 2.2 cent production tax credit, you should compare that to, for example, what Urbana just bought for electricity at 4.1 cents. So the 2.2 cents, in fact, is quite large. But here's my real question. I would like to see from the wind industry or academics a real study that tells me what long lines and storage really are needed for using the wind power. Because right now, the average distance of transmission is a few hundred miles, and the losses are 6% on the grid. And that's not going to change with a smart grid at all. That's just Ohm's law. So to use all this wind that we do have, there has to be, I don't know if it's breakthroughs or miracles in storage, and there certainly has to be a serious study of transmission lines. And if the guest has any comments on, I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Phil?
First, the 4% number is a number that is very widely being circulated as the relevant number for 2011, so moving into 2012. So I have to take issue with the caller's lower numbers in that regard. In terms of transmission, there's no question there are some losses in transmission. However, they're lower than the caller suggested. The numbers that the industry refers to are closer to about 0.5% for every 100 miles of transmission. So if you're transmitting wind-generated power from huge wind farms in Wyoming where the winds are abundant to, let's say, the Las Vegas or Southern California area, 1,000 miles or so, you may experience losses in the neighborhood of 5% of that power. But again, given the superabundance of the wind resource in Wyoming, it looks like it's going to pay off to bring that power into the major load centers of the southwestern United States. We need to develop a balanced grid. We need to use electricity sparingly, and I want to emphasize that as well, because you mentioned earlier in the conversation, Craig, that we can't just continue to produce more and more power. I don't think creating wind farms should be an excuse for us to be energy wasteful and for us not to be much more mindful about the need to conserve energy resources. But if we can use wind-generated power instead of dirtier forms of electricity, then that's a good thing.
Ron is in Atlanta, Illinois. Ron, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Great conversation. I think your guest is right on about everything. I live next to a wind farm, and I also live on a dedicated nature preserve, and birds are part of, you know, a main interest to the nature preserve. And that is always in the back of my mind that this is not good. And because of doing studies on, involved in studies on radio towers, we know how deadly they've been. But and I guess, like the guest said, that that's been mitigated over the last decade quite a bit. But bats now are the new prime evil that is wind farms are affecting bats a lot. Anyway, moving on, I think it's the only way we really have to go. Living in the passive solar house, we forget that in the winter in Illinois is when it's mostly cloudy, so that doesn't really, it works great when it works, but it's got its limitations. So solar has limitations where wind doesn't. A comment on the gentleman that was maybe the farmer that was thinking of putting a wind farm or a wind generator on his own farm. I investigated that several years ago and involved with an REA-type supplier. And actually, you could do it quite cheaply. There's a manufacturer of turbines, I think, in Flagstaff that you could have a turbine and you could put up on a steel pole with some guide wires, a pipe pole, and it would supply enough for your house. And it could be in the less than $5,000 range and be really, really quite effective. The only problem there was storage, like we get back to all the time. So the recommendations, reading different ideas on using the system, was to pipe it back into the grid where you were paid for it rather than actually having to store it on your house. And I talked to my REA guy about it, and at that time absolutely got mad at me, said it wouldn't work. At that time I was retired and I was doing some meter reading for him, and I figured every one of my sites here in the country had the possibility for doing that and putting that all back in the grid and where you could pay for it, like on your utility bill, could be really an easy way to do it. And they said, we have no meters. And at that time, where there's no law that suggests that we have a meter that will read backwards, so we can't do it. So there's been obstacles thrown up against WIM even on the local level, and I just want to get off now, but congratulations on your study. I think it's really our only hope, so thanks.
All right, thanks very much for the call, Ron. Phil, I'll give you a chance to comment briefly, but I do want to try and get in at least one more phone call as well.
Okay, just very briefly, Ron is correct that there really is a need for what is called net metering, which is meters that go in both directions. So you're paying for electricity you're consuming, and you're able to sell electricity you don't need onto the grid if you're generating it from farm from wind and the like. 42 states, I believe it is, have net metering laws which require utilities to make to purchase surplus wind when that wind is available from householders, or if it's solar generated electricity, the same thing. We've got to move in that direction.
All right, let's go next to Lynn in Savoy. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning. Last night, there was in the debate by the president contender that he had said something about the wind farm or the energy things that were tried by the stimulus money, that those companies have gone defunct. Are any of these that you have in your book, or do you know of those that have? I mean, there was no mention of. That's the first I'd heard that they had gone by the wayside.
Yeah, so. Mitt Romney has made enormous political hay out of one company called Solyndra, which was a solar panel manufacturer, actually, that went bankrupt, and it had received a federal loan guarantee. That was part of a program. It was about $500 million loan guarantee. That was part of a $24 billion loan guarantee program. Wind farms have taken advantage of that program to the tune of about $1.6 billion in loan guarantees, and there have been no defaults, zero defaults from wind companies under that program.
We've had some emails come in, and I don't know if we'll be able to get to all of them, but I want to share at least one or two with you here. Bonnie writes,
I'm all for conservation, but what about the health concerns for the people living near these colossal machines, noise, shadows, etc.? She says, I really thought wind was a great resource until I saw the documentary Windfall, filmed in a community in upstate New York. It changes the landscape dramatically, and I believe large-scale projects should not be located near residential areas. Please comment.
There have been numerous studies that have been done looking at the possible health impacts of wind technology. None of those studies have found a linkage to illness. What they have found is that there are some neighbors who have trouble sleeping because of the turbine noise, if the turbines, again, are located too close to their homes, and irritation factors rather than actual serious health impacts. And again, I want to stress, it is important to come up with the appropriate setbacks for wind turbines so that they're not bothering neighbors. Many, many hundreds, thousands of people in America live in the vicinity of wind farms today and are happy, contented neighbors. That needs to be a priority as the wind industry moves forward. Health concerns need to be looked into systematically. Again, no clear evidence of serious health impacts at this point. But noise is a factor that needs to be taken into account.
Phil, I'm afraid we are out of time. I was hoping maybe if I could forward a couple of email questions from listeners to you, maybe you'd be able to respond to them.
Happy to.
Okay, excellent. And I want to point out also to listeners, if you have additional questions, you could visit philipwarburg.com. That's our guest's website, philipwarburg.com.
One L.
Yeah. Philip Warburg is the former president of the Conservation Law Foundation and the author of Harvest the Wind. Phil, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, a conversation about the state of investigative journalism in America. Today's program was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls today. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Craig Cohen.